Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Unsung Heroes. Unsung Heroes.
Hi everybody, this is Ricky Wilde and this is Unsung Heroes. Thank you for joining us. This week we have Gary Osborne. He's an absolute legend. Again, you might not know his name, but he's been behind so many massive hits. War of the Worlds, he wrote with Jeff Wayne, he did all the lyrics. Forever Autumn, probably one of my all-time favourite songs. He also wrote Part-Time Love with Elton John, Little Genie, Blue Eyes. I mean, what a beautiful song. He had a huge number one with Kiki D with the track called Amoureuse, which was absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's so diverse. He also wrote Check It Out for Little Chris. He's had tracks covered by Alice Cooper, Cliff Richard, Wilson Pickett, Jennifer Warnes, Righteous Brothers. I mean, the list goes on. He's done everything there is to do when it comes to the writing process and the lyrical process. He's a fascinating guy. We went up to his place up in St. John's Wood. And there was me, Lee and Jake, and we just had a most lovely chat with him. So, yeah, let's just get straight into this. Ladies and gentlemen, on Unsung Heroes, here is Mr. Gary Osborne.
Guys, first of all, thank you for coming on our podcast, Unsung Heroes.
Well, thank you for being the one who did all the travelling. You tried to entice me down to the studio, I know, on several occasions, but I had to hang out for you coming to visit me.
Well, it's very kind of you and it's lovely to be here. I know some fascinating people, you obviously being one of them. So basically, we just wanted to have a chat with you about your life, about what your interests are, about your musical interests, about you, your history.
This is my specialist subject for Mastermind, myself.
Yeah.
You want me to talk about myself? It must be very difficult to get people in this business to talk about themselves, because we're all so modest. We're all so shy, aren't we?
Well, especially you, guys.
Okay, especially. I'm especially shy.
Yeah, so I've got a few questions that...
Go for it. I'll ignore them.
And if there's anything you're not sure about and you want to ask us, please fire away.
Okay.
We're here. We're all ears. So, Gaz, you were born in 1949.
Oh, you had to mention that.
Ish.
Yes.
Let's say ish.
Definitely 1949.
Yeah. And you're the son of a musical director called Tony Osborne.
Yes, my fabulous father. He was an arranger, conductor, composer. He's got two Ivor Novellos.
Amazing.
And a fantastic pianist and a brilliant bloke. Dad worked with all the big stars of the day in the late 50s and early 60s. Shirley Bassey, he worked famously with I Who Have Nothing. That was the first session I ever went to when I was about 12 or 13. I would, you know, go to work with Dad Day. Can you imagine?
And amazing.
Abbey Road, that had a 50 or 60 piece orchestra, including Timps, Shirley singing live with the orchestra, George Martin up in the box producing, and I'm just sitting there quiet as a mouse. Wow, why the hell would I want to do anything other than this with my life? So that's what I'd done.
And how old were you then?
Then I was about 13, but I'd already decided to be a songwriter. We had a flat down on the coast, And in the same block, there was also Norman Newell, who's also a famous sod, famous songwriter, who wrote 16 songs for Shirley Bassey. He wrote More Than the Greatest Love the World. But he was also a top producer, and my dad worked with him all the time. And also in the same block was a guy called Cyril Ornadell. Cyril Ornadell wrote the musical Pickwick. He was the conductor of Sunday Night at the London Palladium. And he wrote, If I Ruled the World, things like that. Mm. And we're having this party, I'm about eight. And Norman Newell said, I'm just going to go out now, Gary. I'm going to go and visit Uncle Cyril downstairs. I'll be back a little bit later. I said, okay. So I said, what are you going to do, Uncle Norman? He said, I'm going to go and write a song. So he got back about an hour later. And 3 months later, when the song called Portrait of My Love was in the top three by Matt Munro. There will never be a portrait of my love. I said, Dad said, that's the song Norman wrote that day. I said, is this making a lot of money? Is this making a fortune? It's number three in the charts. I said, but he was only gone an hour. And that was the very moment I decided to become a songwriter.
Yeah.
I thought, these are the guys. The people around my house, Lionel Bart was around the house a lot. Yeah. There were lots of songwriters, lots of musicians, lots of great musical turns. Dad also conducted the last concert that Judy Garland ever did.
Wow.
Johnny Mathis, Eartha Kitt. He toured with Eartha for a couple of years. And wow. These were the people around my house all the time. It was the Frankie Vaughan or, Al McCogan.
Yeah.
I grew up with all these people around and I was always going to be in this business, or I was always going to try.
Yeah. And so what was the first song that you wrote? When did you start writing?
I went to school in Switzerland. And when I was 15, I came home for the long summer holiday. And there was a really great record that was in the charts, a French record. And I loved this record, so I bought it for my dad to play mum and dad when I got home. On the plane, I realised that they didn't speak French, so they weren't going to know what the song was about. So I started translating it. But of course, because I've grown up with a musical sensibility and around songwriters, you can't translate. The rhymes don't work, the scans don't work, the stresses don't work. So I started rewriting the lyric, keeping the meaning, but making it work like a proper song, just so I could play it to mum and dad. When I played it to them, they said, bloody hell, that's good. They found out who the publisher was. It happened to be someone dad knew. Mm. Down at Robin's Music, Stuart Reed, he was called. They took me down there and said, look, Gary's written a lyric to this, you publish it, can you use it? He said, Hal Shaper, who's a very famous songwriter at the time, his big song was Softly, I Will Leave You, Softly. Sinatra did it, Matt Munro again. He said, Hal Shaper's just done a lyric to it. But I really like Gary's lyric. He said, here's another French tune. Go and write that. And if I like that, I'll give you an advance. This is the first week of my holiday. In the second week, Hal Shaper phoned me up. He said, I've just seen the lyric you wrote to the song that I wrote one to. I said, yeah. He said, well, yours is better than mine. And I'm a publisher too, and I've got some foreign songs. Will you come in? So now I'm 15. It's now week two of my holiday. I'm writing songs for two publishers.
15.
I thought, this is good. This is it. I always wanted to be a songwriter. I wrote a little song of my own. My dad's publisher sent it off, got a cover in Germany by Nana Mouskouri, who was a very big actor at the time. I'm talking about 1964. So I'm now like week four, and I've got a record out in Germany. I've got two publishers commissioning me. Dad's writing the music for a movie called Every Day's a Holiday, holiday camp film, where all the stars, John Layton, Mike Sarm, Mitch Murray's wife, Grazina Frame, wasn't it? Freddie and the Dreamers were in it, the Mojos were in it. It was a British pop film.
Yeah.
And all the British character actors, Nicholas Parsons, Michael Ripper, you know, all the guys were in it. And all finished with them all getting together and winning the talent competition. And loads of people were allowed to submit a song for this. And Kenny Lynch submitted one. He just had Sha-La-La-La-Li with the Small Faces. Mort Schumann, the great Mort Schumann of so many wonderful Elvis songs, he'd written one. Dad and I wrote one. They chose our song. So now, week six of my 8-week holiday, I've got a song in a movie.
Gosh.
And I went to the session, and John Paul Jones on bass, Jimmy Page on second guitar, Big Jim Sullivan on first guitar. So I got half of Led Zeppelin on my first recording. Yeah. And it's been downhill ever since.
And of course, Jim Sullivan was
Great. Jimmy Page used to do rhythm, and Jim would always play lead on
Jim
the sessions.
Jim played in my dad's band for a while.
Of course he did. Of course he did. He was a wildcat.
Yeah.
And Brian Bennett was a wildcat.
Yeah,
wow. Oh man! Yeah. I mean, of course, that's why we love each other, because we're both second generation,
and we have history, don't we?
And we got the history.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So that was it. The end of the holiday came. The 10-week holiday.
Yeah.
And Dad says, "Well, I suppose it's time to go back to." I said, "Go back to Switzerland." I said, "I want to be a songwriter. Yeah. Here am I, actually accidentally being a songwriter. I mean, by the way, it was another 10 years till I actually had a hit, but." I can't go back now. And he said, well, you're not even allowed to leave school yet. I said, yeah, but the people in England don't know I've left the Swiss school, and the people in Switzerland don't know I'm not going to an English one. So I just left school and
that was it.
Started songwriting. Yeah.
Amazing.
It took an awful long time before I made any money at it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, you've got to start somewhere, and that was it. So it's a beautiful accident, really.
Amazing.
Everything, if there's a theme in my life, it's luck.
Yeah.
Just luck. Because if I hadn't...
It's the same with all of us, I think, Gaz, isn't it? We all have that lucky break. Obviously, mine was Mickey Most.
Well, luck is when... that success is when opportunity meets preparation.
Yeah.
And the luck, I happened to be able to do the songs that were given to me to do. That was the luck, you know, that was the preparation.
Yeah.
The luck was being given them. I mean, when first song I wrote with Elton, totally, I came right out of the blue.
How did that happen?
We were mates because Kiki's first hit, Kiki was the first signing to Elton's label, Rocket Records.
Yeah.
And Elton produced her first album.
Yeah.
And the first hit was Amoureuse.
What a tune.
Very pretty French love song.
What a beautiful song.
The lyric to. And so it was Elton's first hit as a producer. And he was just every bit as excited as I was, because it was something that he'd never done before. And he was having, you know, that validation of people going out, putting money on the counter to buy it. That's the most incredible, humbling thing, by the way.
Yeah.
So Kiki's first hit, Rocket Records' first hit. So we bonded and we were chums.
Yeah.
So we'd been hanging out together for a couple of years. We played a lot of poker. I don't think it's any secret we took a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
I'm not proud of that, but that's what happened. I'm very glad I don't do that anymore, unless you've got any on you.
Yeah.
And one night, I don't know, 3 or 4 in the morning, he went and sat down at my dad's grand piano. He said, "What do you think of this tune?" And he just played this tune. And I said, "Oh God, that's beautiful." He said, "I don't usually write tunes." He said, I get given a lyric by Bernie.
Yeah.
And I get given a poem by Bernie, and I turn the poem into a song.
Mm.
He said, "Well, here's a tune, and it needs turning into a song. Do you fancy having a go at it?" And I said, "Well, oh, hold on," I said, because I really wouldn't want to upset Bernie, but, you know.
So up until that point, Bernie had written everything.
Everything. Elton hadn't written a song with anybody.
With anyone else.
Anybody at all. There's an oblique reference to this in the movie where Bernie and him are having a little row, and he says, "Well, I think I'll write with somebody else then." He said, "Why don't you?" "Well, that was me." Bernie, incidentally, went off and wrote with Alice Cooper at that stage. Bernie was living in L.A. And they were never as estranged as people imagined. But the distance, you know, 12,000 miles between.
Yes.
And basically, Elton fancied trying it the other way around.
Yeah.
Tunes first, which is what I do. Yeah. And it's not what Bernie does. But when he gave me that that tune, he told what I suspect was a lie. Because I said, "Well, what about, you know, I wouldn't want to step on Bernie's toes, because that's Taupin and John, you know, for me to write."
Yeah.
But I thought, just to write one song with you would be brilliant on my CV, you know. He said, "No, it's okay, I've played it to Bernie and he couldn't come up with anything." Now, I'm not sure whether that was true. But at least it allowed me the freedom to say, well, I'll have a go. I casually said, yeah, well, I'll give it a shot when I've got the time, you know. Yeah. So he knew I could do it.
Yeah.
But of course, if when he gave me that tune and he said, oh, see if you can come up with anything, and I very casually said, yeah, well, you know, when I've got the time, I'll give it a shot, you know. And of course, the second he left at 4 o'clock, 5 minutes past four, I got the pen out, the rhyming dictionary, the tape recorder, and it was all done by six in the morning. You know, I was like, this could be the biggest break of my life. Actually, it turned out to be that.
Yeah, incredible.
The tune, he was semi-retired at the time, and he hadn't written with Bernie for a year or so, and he hadn't written anything. And he had to do the Morecambe and Wise Christmas show. Now, this was the biggest rated TV show that's ever been on. Their Christmas shows were massive, and this was the biggest of their shows. It was the one where all the newscasters that sung There's Nothing Like a Dame.
Yes, yes.
And Elton spent the whole time through the show trying to find the studio. They'd worked out he was too expensive for them. So they'd given him the wrong, you know, he walked through and there's Kenneth Kendall reading the news. And Kenneth, he says, look, do you know where this studio is? He said, through that door. And he walks through the door and falls in the river.
Yeah.
And at the end, the credits roll. And Elton told me I had the song in them. Can you imagine? I'm in a room and all my family's in the other room. And everyone I know has been told that I have written a song with Elton, and nobody believed it because Elton didn't write with anybody else. With me, I was a jingle singer. Yeah. You know, I was doing it, and my biggest hit at that point was, got it all a-going, got my savings growing, got the Abbey habit with Abbey National. The credits rolled, and I thought, oh my God, they've cut it. I am never going to be able to leave this room. Ever again, I am too embarrassed. After the credits, Elton comes in and there's Morecambe and Wise dressed as cleaning ladies. Yeah. And he says, excuse me, it's Morecambe. Oh, you've missed it. You've missed it. They were very good. They were very good. I like the short one. Oh, the guy with the glasses. They're dressed as cleaning ladies. He said, but I was going to sing a song, a new song. He said, oh, we'll have to take that with them. He said, well, I'm here now. Do you want to hear it? And without answering, they both shrugged their shoulders like, if you must. So I sat down and played my song. And at the end of it, as the music died away, he said, that was what I was going to play on the Morecambe and Wise show. And Eric Morecambe says, it's a good job you didn't. So we went in to demo it. We went in to demo it. As we're demoing it, he writes another tune in the coffee break. So I took that away and came back with another lyric. So he demoed that, he wrote another tune. And suddenly, 5 years had gone by and we've written 35 songs, spread over 5 albums, incredible, including some hits, Part Time Love. Little Genie was a million seller in the States, well, not so big here, but it's a month in the top 3 in the States. Blue Eyes, of course, thank God, the one that bought the house.
Yeah.
And some B-sides and some songs for movies, and it was just the greatest roller coaster, And then one day, the record company said, look, sales aren't what they were. Well, by this time, he'd made 25, 30 albums, and you're fighting your own back catalogue at this point. You know, are people going to buy the 25th Elton John album, or are they going to get the second Pretenders album? You know, you've already got 3 yards of Elton John albums in your collection, literally. Well, not yards, but 3 feet of them. Yeah.
Incredible.
So, the record company said, look, why don't you just bring the old band back together and just do it with Bernie, and it's the old life. They didn't sell anymore. 3 of the albums, Bernie and I had half songs each.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it was just a coincidence, but I had all the singles.
Yeah.
So,
no coincidence.
No, listen, I have the greatest respect and affection.
Do you know Bernie?
I know Bernie. Yeah. I think he went off me. We were friends.
Oh, okay.
But not great close buddies, but we were mates, you know. Well, I think he kind of went off me when I was writing with him. I don't think he was mad about it. His manager once said, Bernie quite likes you, but we do kind of wish you didn't exist.
Yeah.
Which is a nice thing to say. I didn't know what, but I understood. You know, I always felt like cuckoo in the nest.
Yeah,
but
you've
got to remember, we were writing the other way around. Yeah. And that was why it was an addition rather than a replacement. And then basically, he just went back to writing it the other way.
Yeah.
And that was me out of a job.
Yeah.
And people say, oh my God, aren't you so upset, you know, not to be writing without me anymore? Well, of course, part of me is, because it was the most wonderful experience.
Yeah.
But then I look at the house I live in, and I say, how can I be upset? One song bought this bloody house.
Incredible.
What an ungrateful bastard I would be if I was going to be upset. I was lucky.
Mm.
I thought it was going to be one song.
Yeah.
So it turned out to be 30 or 40. Amazing. I'm luckiest man on earth.
When you wrote with Elton, did he give you a steer as to what the lyrics should be about, or was it a blank page?
I've written with lots and lots of people. Some of my nicest songs were written with Richard Kerr. You must do him. He's beautiful songs like Mandy he wrote and Looks Like We Made It. And I know I'll never love this way. I've written with all sorts of people, but never anyone like Elton. Mm. And what he would do with me was when he was putting it down on cassette for me, he would sing a dummy lyric. He would sing the first thing that came into his head. And I would either take a steer from that or completely ignore it. And very often I would take my steer from what he... Just the... He'd go, Blue Eyes. That was his title. Yeah. Blue Eyes. I said, can I change the title? Can I change... He said, you can change anything. But that was the one time he wouldn't let me change the title, because he was going out with a boy with blue eyes. Yeah. Very nice lad. No longer with us. Fan. Very nice. And it was his song for him. And... So he would sing some words and I would take one line, because what I was trying to do was put, you see, he had been singing Bernie's life. He had been singing Bernie's feelings.
Yes.
He'd been singing Bernie's thoughts.
Yeah.
And I wanted to put a little bit more of himself into the songs.
Yeah.
So he said, this is a song, and he said, dear God, blah, 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 da, 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 dear God, da, da, da. I could see where the title's coming. It makes it a lot easier if you get given a title and you like it.
Yeah.
But that, before I could write that, I didn't want to write about what I felt about God. So I had a long discussion. How did you feel about God? What are your feelings? And I tried to then put that into the song.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did that over and over again, because it was a project for me, you know.
Yeah.
And the day he wrote, but it's, you know, the Yellow Brick Road album, which is about 25 songs, and probably his best ever album, and including Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Goodbye Norma Jean. So,
it's just hit after hit.
Saturday Night's the Right for a Fight, Someone Saved My Life Tonight. This is an incredible, every tune he wrote in one weekend. Bernie gives him a stack of lyrics, he puts it up on the piano, and he tinkers around, and if in 5 to 10 minutes he's got a song, then that's the song. And if he hasn't, it goes in the bin.
Wow.
And he just did, you know, I guess maybe about a dozen the first day, a dozen the second day. You wouldn't think that's...
No.
I mean...
I've never even thought about writing from a lyric. That for me, is a really strange...
Yes.
...archaic way of writing.
But then, with the tunes first, I went down... He said, oh, we've got to write some songs. Why don't you come down to the house at 1 o'clock? So I arrived there at 1. And I was about an hour late, because of the traffic. I got there at 2. He said, oh, a bit late, are you? I said, well, I'm sorry about that. He said, I started at 1. I said, how's it going? He said, oh, I've got 5 tunes for you. 5 bloody tunes in an hour. He played me them all, each one. I recorded them. And then I went home and spent 3 months doing lyrics to what had taken him 1 hour to do.
No,
and of those 5 songs, there was 3 album tracks, 1 B-side. No, 3 album tracks, 1 B-side, 1 song which went out in the movie, and Blue Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one I didn't like. It's amazing how a song grows on you once it's bought a house. I thought, stopping, see, what he used to do, he used to give me a tune.
It's a stunning tune, though, Gaz.
Oh, it's beautiful, but I thought, stopping. He'd give me a tune.
I remember you telling me about him recording the vocal on it.
He did 5 goes at it.
5 goes, yeah.
Yeah. But because he'd given me 5 songs, I did them in the order of which I liked them. And also because sometimes he'd give me a tune and I'd come back with a lyric that I'd sweated over and he'd say, no, I've gone off it. And he wouldn't even look. He would not even look at the lyrics. I've gone off that tune. Well, I'm not going to say, well, I did say, you bastard. You know, but I'm not going to get too angry because, you know, it's Elton John. It's his prerogative, you know. So my trip was now to work out which song he wouldn't want. And I thought, that's the one, he's not going to want that one, really. It's all soppy and he's loved up with this boy. And as soon as he's finished with the boy, he'll finish with the song. And so I kept putting it off. And I did the other four. And it's so long ago, it was before email. We were communicating by telex. Remember telex?
Mm.
And he kept saying, have you done Blue Eyes yet? And I said, no, but I'm working on Ball and Chain. It's all right. Have you done Blue Eyes yet? And eventually, a cassette arrived in the post. He did the backing track without a lyric to let me know that he meant business.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got this backing track. It's only quite a short song. And I thought, Christ, if he could send that to me, he could send it to Bernie. I'd better be quick.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went out in Regent's Park. And 2 hours later, I came back and telexed him the lyric, which is not as clever as it sounds because there's only two verses in it. But then he did five shots at the vocal. He did one that sounded a bit like Elvis.
Yeah.
And one that sounded a bit like Dean Martin. One that was a bit like Fats Domino.
Yeah.
With the triplets. And one that sounded like... And the one he ended up with, it was one that's... Oh, he did one that sounded just like Elton John.
Yeah.
But the one he's got sounds a bit like all of them. It's a little bit Elvis-y, a little bit Dean Martin-y, always croony. I'm so glad. I'm so glad that he did do it.
Yeah.
And when they said it's going to be the first single, I said, you're mad, don't put that out as a single. That's so corny. It's so corny.
Yeah.
So good job I was wrong about that.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
And what a beautiful string arrangement.
Lovely, lovely. Was it James Newton Howard? I think it was James Newton Howard.
Wow. Stunning. But the whole production.
Who went on to become like an Oscar winning.
He does TV and
movie scorer. Yeah. You know? He came up with the theme from ER, and then it was. I mean, they had a night of him at the. He was in Elton's band, James, but now he's one of the along with Hans Zimmer, the top guys, and John Williams, top guys in movies, movie scores.
So, did Gus Dudgeon produce or
no? That was Chris Thomas.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I only worked with Gus once because Elton had parted even with Davey. On the first album, it was called A Single Man. And Elton produced himself on that first album.
Yeah. Which, but Chris was an amazing producer.
He produced himself on a couple of albums that I was associated with. He and Clive Franks, his engineer, who was a wonderful guy in the studio, also played bass on a lot of the tracks, well, from the desk.
Mm-hmm.
But the two of them, they were very good. But you know, producing Elton's time... He's talent-rich and time-poor.
Yeah.
That's why he doesn't write his own lyrics. He's talented enough to write them. But they take a lot longer.
Yeah.
You've got to polish them. You've got to move them about. You've got to, you know, a tune, when you sing it, it can take as long to write as it takes to sing.
Yes.
Which indeed is how he works. He sings a tune, comes out of his head, and he plays it again. If he can remember it, then it must have been good. Third time, that's it. That's the song. Put the paper away, that's it.
Amazing.
But
isn't it?
So Elton produced his own, but in fact... he insisted that I get a production point on the albums that he was producing himself because I took care of a lot of the backing vocals because I'd been a backing vocalist and he didn't have Davey D and Nigel anymore. Yeah. And also when he wasn't there, I would sit in the seat and you know, pretend I knew what I was doing. And so I produced the horns on Little Genie and things like the backing vocals. But then Chris Thomas came in, who's a fantastic, what a track record, Chris
Incredible.
Thomas, who starts out as George Martin's assistant, ends up producing half the White Album. He's a
Amazing.
Kid who's never done anything before in that, you know. What a learning curve. Goes on to produce The Pretenders, Brass in the Pocket, Roxy Music, all the Sex Pistols hits, the Pulp hits, Common People, Anarchy in the UK. What a breath. And Blue, you would think that the guy who produced I Am an Antichrist also produced Blue Eyes, which is, you know, this is just...
Oh, an incredible talent. I remember Chris from years ago, and when I was producing in Kimmy at Rack, I'd go up to... at that time, I was going out with a lady that was working at Air Studio, so I'd be up there quite a lot, and Chris was always there, and he's working with the Pretenders at that time.
Yeah, and Bill Price on engineering, another great engineer.
Yeah, and Renata was there at the time.
Renata
as well.
Doing a tape op.
Yeah,
yeah. In the movie, she's been promoted to engineer, but she was a tape op.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing wrong with being a tape op.
No, but I've got to know like all the guys at AIR and George Martin and everyone. It's a wonderful time. But Chris was always one of my heroes. And whenever I spoke to him, I always felt a little bit nervous.
And yet he was probably more nervous than you. He's not a bombastic guy in any way. I loved him.
I think he was doing the Human League stuff. Fascination, I think it was. Keep Feeling Fascination.
Could be, although their original stuff, certainly the big early stuff was Martin Rushen, who I used to work with at AdVision. Yeah.
Well, I think
when I was a term.
It was post Martin Rushen, but yes. And then they were trying different
just
things.
Just the greatest, a lovely bloke. And when we were working at AIR in Montserrat, of course, the desk is looking towards the studio, yes. But there's a mirror out onto the pool and beyond it, the mountains.
I remember it. I went on the holiday.
And of course, those mountains ended up erupting.
Yes.
And buried the whole island, let alone the
tragedy.
Studio.
Yeah.
Tragic.
Yeah.
But he was always, always looking out the window. It was like he wasn't interested in the session. He was just looking out the window. I said to him one day, do you mind me asking, Chris, what is it out there that's so fascinating that you spend all your time looking out that window? He said, well, actually, I'm deaf in one ear. All I'm doing is keeping the one that works towards the speakers.
I never knew that.
Isn't that incredible?
Amazing.
Totally deaf in his left ear.
Amazing.
So he wasn't looking out the window. He was just turning his right ear towards the speakers.
The last time I saw Chris was at the Gold Badge Awards when Kimmy was there.
Yeah.
And that was the last time I saw him. And he came up to me and goes, do you remember me? I said, yeah, I do.
You know what, though?
And it was so
as great a guy as he is, right? This is about me. So screw him. Screw him. Screw you, Chris, if you're listening to this. I've talked about you long enough. I bet he's not talking about me.
Can I ask you something, Gary?
Well, yeah, please.
You mentioned earlier about your dad winning a couple of Ivor Novellos.
Yeah.
I believe you got one, but slightly belatedly.
You've been on Google.
There's a little story. I read an interview.
It's a fantastic story. It's a fantastic story. My dad won two Ivors. He was nominated four times and won twice. And the statuette is so beautiful. And
do you remember when
you've got loads, haven't you? Sorry, Ricky.
Gary, do you remember when he won those awards?
59 and 61. The one of them was a song called Windows of Paris, and it was the theme song of the Drive Time show on the Light program. He was in the Light Orchestral department of the Ivors. Light Orchestral was a very big thing in the early late 50s, mm-hmm. early 60s. Anyway, cut to several years later when the War of the Worlds had its big success in 78, and the people at Basker clearly didn't bother to listen to it. They just knew it was selling bucket loads of records. They thought they'd be able to give it a prize. So they gave Jeff Wayne an Ivor for that. But of course it's for the writers, and there are half a dozen guest artists, and they're all singing My Bloody Words. But I wasn't offered an Ivor. I wasn't even invited. I actually wrote to them and said, you know, this is, you wouldn't give Sullivan without Gil, but you wouldn't give Bacharach without David. You know, this is not fair. And they said, you're right, it's not fair. Sorry about that, but we don't correct these things if they go wrong. It's just going to suck it up. So I sucked it up. But a couple of years later, I joined the Ivors committee.
Yeah. You were chairman of the...
And went on after about 10 years to become the chairman of the committee for a dozen years. Yeah. So when my dad left to emigrate to Australia, he gave both the Ivors to my sister.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I always kind of thought, well, he got two, you could have given us one each. But he said, no, he says, you're a songwriter, you can get your own. Like as if you can. I mean, it's very rare to get an Ivor. It's almost unheard. You know, it's massively difficult.
Yeah.
Some great writers have never had an Ivor, you know. And I said, oh, I couldn't argue with him. You know, it was his to give to my sister, and it was kind of nice that he did.
Yeah.
Anyway, a couple of years later, I'm the chairman of the Ivors, and a guy called Pete phoned up from Croydon, phoned up Basker and said, I've got an Ivor Novello Award, and I've had it for 10 years. As using it as a doorstop, but I said, I think it's probably worth a few bob, and I'm going to put it up for sale. But before I do, I should offer it to the guy whose name's on it. And they said, well, whose name's on it? They said, Gary Osborne. Well, they burst out laughing. They said, no, his name is definitely not on it, because not only has he never had an Ivor, he's been bitching about it for like 30 years. He's been bitching about this for 30... The people at the committee used to talk about... Some of the guys had Ivors that were on the committee. I didn't, but they always said that I had a virtual Ivor because technically I should have won one on Ivor, never did.
Yeah.
So get over it. Well, I went down to Croydon to see this thing, and it was very wackery and it was falling apart, but there was my name. So this is 32 years later. He said, do you want to buy it? I said, no, you know... He reckoned he could get about a grand for it. And I, as the chairman of the Ivors, knew they cost us 450 to make. So I said, no, I said, I'm empowered to offer you 450 for it for the songwriters organization. But I wouldn't recommend you take that offer. If you can get more, get more, you know. At least I know it exists, and maybe I can make me a new one now that they've seen. What had happened was that the PRS used to organise the making of the awards. So although Basker had not put me down for an award, the PRS, who make the award, had gone through the files and seen that alongside Jeff Wayne's name was my name. So they'd naturally assumed that I was supposed to have it. It had gone down to the Grosvenor House to be presented, but I wasn't there. So when everybody's had their Ivors, there's one left. And I think one of the cleaners took it, or one of the waiters, because nobody knows where it was for 20 years.
Nice.
This guy had it for 12, but nobody knows where it was for the
evening. You didn't even know it existed.
I didn't know it existed. I would have insisted they make me a replica. Then he phoned me up and he said, Harry, I've been thinking about this. I think I could get more than 400, but there's only one person that should have this, and that's you. Can you get me the 400? I said, no, I can get you the 450, which is what they cost us to make.
Yeah.
So I went and picked it up and brought it in to the office, and they all saw it, and they parted with a check for the guy, so he was quite happy, and there was the Ivor. And then they said, now, are you going to get this presented at the Ivors? I said, oh, yeah, that's great. I'm the chairman of the Ivors. I sit down at the meeting and I say, right, first thing we're going to do is give me an award. No, that's not going to happen. We don't do that.
Yeah.
But what was very nice was my friend Lewis Carney, who runs Radio 2. They had a Friday night is music night, which is just a brilliant show on Friday nights with the whole BBC concert orchestra. They had an Ivor Novello special. Mike Batt performed and also conducted the orchestra, and it was a wonderful, wonderful event. And in the middle of it, they presented it to me live on the air. Paul Gambaccini, who was hosting the show and is the host of the Ivors. And Paul presented it to me in front of this 60-piece orchestra, in front of this lovely...
wonderful.
Gave me this award 32 years later.
And the guy, I think, that sold it to you, he got it on a car boot sale, didn't he?
He'd got it for 50 quid in a car boot sale. But nobody knew where it was until that car boot sale. It was about a 20-year gap that nobody knew where it was.
Incredible.
And the only sad part about it is that that makes me and my dad the only father and son. In the 65 years of the Ivors, we're the only father and son, or the only first and second generation to have won an Ivor. And he died without knowing that I had got it. And that when he said to me, oh, you can get your own, I actually already had. Because that was 1980, and I should have got given it in 1976.
It sounded like he had belief that you would get one anyway.
Isn't that lovely? I don't know if he believed in me that much. I'd kind of proved myself that I could make a living at it by the time he snuffed it, bless him. I didn't have a tenth of his talent. I don't have, you know, I mean, but that's fantastic. That's, you know, I mean, he was a... You know,
beautiful man.
He was one of those proper musicians like Les Reed, who our dear friend who just died. You know, sit down, you want to hear a tune, doesn't matter, whatever song you want to play. Richard Kerr, when he sits down to play Mandy, you think, what a brilliant pianist.
Incredible.
Ask him to play any other song that he didn't write, he wouldn't know where to begin. But people like my dad, and of course they read the dots. They read the chords, they do arrangements. The arrangers are the unsung heroes of our business. That's who you want to interview. Talk about unsung heroes, arrangers. Someone like Richard Hewison you want to interview. You'll interview Mike Batt eventually, and he's a great arranger.
Mike's already agreed to do it, bless him.
He's a great arranger.
I can't wait to chat.
And he'll have better stories than me, damn him.
So what the music, the songs that won you the award was War of the Worlds.
It was the entirety of the War of the Worlds.
Did you have any idea that that would be, you know, sort of still being reinterpreted now?
When Jeff asked me to do the lyrics for this concept album was making, I thought maybe it would, you know, I could see it was good, and we worked on it for a couple of years, and I could tell it was going really well. But I'd had... no hits. And I had, I'd had Amoureuse. But, you know, the ratio of songs written to hits was so short that I had gone beyond the point. In fact, I think it's a safety thing. You just don't expect anything to really be big because you're going to be so disappointed.
Of course.
And the few times when I've actually thought, this is the one, this is going to be... And then it isn't. And then Blue Eyes, which I didn't like when I said, don't put it out... hit in every country in the world. You know, so you don't know. You write, we write songs, the public make hits.
Yeah.
We don't make hits. I mean, of course, you need a bit of help. You need a Dave Most, you need a good plugger, you need a record company behind you, and you need a bit of luck.
Yeah.
But War of the Worlds is still being played, you know, and reinterpreted now in you know, enormous shows.
Oh, yes. It's 40 years old now. It's just done over Christmas. It did its seventh arena tour. I mean, I went to see it at the O2. There's a different cast each time. Jason Donovan's been in it two or three times. He keeps coming back in different roles because he loves the show. Yeah. It's the gift that keeps on giving for me. Yeah. I thought maybe that might be... I'd had so many... You know, I'd made a couple of albums that hadn't, you know, we'd had a small hit in the States, we'd had top three in a single in Japan, you know, but then never actually went, you know, you keep thinking, this is the big break, and you think, And so you got your break early.
I was very lucky.
And so therefore, I always suspect that people who get a break too early think that that's the way it's done. The way it really is that you keep trying until something happens. And almost it's bad to happen immediately. You struggled a bit before.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I didn't expect it to. I didn't expect it to sell. What's it? 17 million copies.
Incredible.
And five arena tours. And people, kids know it. People. I mean, it's just a thrill for me to be associated. Also, the key song in it, which is Forever Autumn.
Yeah. Stunning tune. But that kicked off. Wasn't that a jingle to kick off
it? Yeah. Yeah. It started out as a Lego toys commercial. See, luck again. And then it was. I had a partner, and we were called Vigrass and Osborne, and we made a couple of albums, and we were almost broke in America. Then bad luck happened. The guy who signed us, who loved us, who had put us into the top 50, who had spent a lot of money, who had got us great reviews, he left to form 20th Century Records for Barry White, and the new guy came in, and the last act he was going to work on was the act that the previous guy was in the business, in the midst of making a hit. You know, the new broom wants to sweep clean, bring in his own discovery. He's going to hide into nothing. If he made a hit, if he made stars out of us, the other guy was always going to get the credit. So, you know, luck works both ways, and that's fair enough.
So nothing happened with Forever Autumn then?
Well, it was the B-side of our small hit in the States, but in Japan they turned it over, and it was number three in the charts.
Oh, OK.
And we actually went and did gigs in Japan on the back of it. We were going to be the new
song. With the same lyrics, with the Forever
Autumn? Yeah, exactly that song, just taken a bit faster.
Yeah, yeah.
Just taken a bit faster. Very... You know, very similar.
So Jeff produced that. Did Jeff produce?
Jeff produced Vigrass and Osborne.
And that was the connection between.
See, Vigrass and I, we were mates, and we started singing commercials for Jeff.
Yeah.
And Jeff was the biggest. The only other people comparable were Cook and Greenaway at that stage in the early 70s. But we were singing. So Jeff wrote commercials day in, day out. But whenever he needed vocals, me and my partner Paul would either sing them. Mm-hmm. Or we would book the singers, and of course, as the booker, I was booking myself. Mm. You know, so I got to
got all the good gigs,
get a lot of nice gigs. Because although the fee was 15 quid for doing a session for an hour, which still in 1971 too was probably almost the average weekly wage, but they paid us in those days. They paid us royalties every time the commercial was on. I had to take a pay cut to work with Elton John. I tell you, man, this was I was in hog heaven with these commercials. Mm. But I mean, you name it. I was singing the gas ads against the electricity ads. Mm. The singers I was booking, people who became David Essex, I was using Julie Covington. I was just used. Yeah. Julie sung Blue Band for me. David sung Pledge. Let the sun come into your life.
Yeah, I remember that.
Bring me the sun. I had little Linda Lewis singing the. Spangles commercial. Yeah. Here we come with something new. Spangles, made them just for you, sucker. Spangles, get happy. And all these people.
Elvis Costello, he did a bit, didn't he?
Well, I didn't hire him, but he did. I think he did.
White's Lemonade.
Oh, White's. Yeah, Secret Lemonade Drinker.
Yeah.
It was always very short notice. Jeff would phone me in the afternoon or the evening, said, right, for tomorrow I need. And the sessions. Because they're all done at short notice, they're all done in the morning, in the downtime, because all the sessions go, as you know, from 10 till 1, and from 2 till 5, and then from 7 till... So they're three-hour clumps. Mm-hmm. So if you have to get into a studio at very short notice, you can always get in between 7 and 10 in the morning, because no rock sensible musician wants to work before 10.
Yeah.
But we do, all the musicians would come in like... 7, Ray Cooper and all the various musicians, they'd go after an hour, we'd come in and do the singing, then Richard Briers or someone like that would come in and do the voiceover, and that's another commercial.
Yeah.
And when I was totally stuck and I could not get the singer and the session is now going to be at 8 in the morning, I'd go down to Speakeasy, which was the club that all the people in the business went to in Margaret Street and so on. I'd go down there about midnight and I'd find a bloody singer. They asked me, do you remember Resurrection Shuffle by Ashton Gardner and Dyke?
Yeah.
That was in the charts. They said, we want it to sound like that guy. I could not get, I'm on the phone, all the guys that sound a bit like Tony Ashton, I couldn't get them. Not for 10 minutes, 8 the next morning. Everyone loved working for me because it was only an hour's work, but they got royalties.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get anyone, so I went down the Speakeasy. Who was playing there? Ashton Gardner and Dyke. Tony, I've got a little something for you. He didn't even go to bed. We left there at 4, went and had a cup of tea, went to the studio, he sung the commercial. And said, did you get someone like Tony Ashton? I said, yeah, I got Tony Ashton. Graham Bonnet I got, who was, since you've been gone, he was the lead singer for Rainbow at the time. I had him, same thing, copped him down the speakeasy.
Amazing.
It was a great, very exciting, lovely time.
Yeah. You were A&R at RCA for a while?
Yes, I started out there. You see, you have to make a living while you're waiting for a break.
What was that transition like?
Remember I mentioned that I was doing song... Well, I don't know if you're going to cut it out, but I was writing lyrics for a publisher called Hal Shaper, mm-hmm. A publisher-writer. And eventually, he offered me a job as his plugger. Now, it was a shit company, and they had no good songs. So I was plugging. I had to go around the BBC. I'm 18... and try to get them to play songs that I hated, that were rubbish.
Yeah.
And boy, what a lesson that was. Mm. For a songwriter, every songwriter should be a plugger for a little while. You realise what it's really about. Because if you grab the best song in the world, if you can't get it on the radio, forget it. Mm. It's over. And So I used to go down there. In fact, I had my own radio show on the BBC World Service because one of the producers there took a fancy to me and got me doing that. But after 6 months of working for Hal Shaper, RCA opened up and they got a great music man called Terry Oates to run it. And he hired me and Richard Kerr as his A&R men.
Yeah.
And so for a year, those were the only two jobs I've ever had, the 6 months working for Hal Shaper as a plugger. And the year at RCA, and those are the only proper jobs I've ever had.
Yeah.
Incidentally, Hal Shaper paid me £15 a week to be his plugger. And also, because I was there on site, he would give me tunes to write lyrics to. Mm. And we would do them together, often. He would start it and make me finish it. Mm. Or he would have me start it and he would finish it.
Yeah.
Now, he was a professional lyricist, and sitting with him, seeing how you fill a page and how you have give a song a beginning, a middle, and an end. It was like a masterclass. Mm. I was getting... Now, when I left, I discovered that this 15 quid a week I'd been getting, 10 of it had been an advance against royalties. So I was actually working for a fiver a week. Mm. Now, my fares and my sandwiches at lunchtime came to about a fiver. So I was basically working for him for nothing for the whole 6 months. But I always say, I said this in his obituary, I should have been paying him. Because I learned more in that 6 months. Yeah. I learned about the writing of a lyric.
Yeah.
So we can't sit around, as Don Black says, that... inspiration is for losers, he says. You know, if it's got to be done by Thursday, it's got to be done by Thursday. Nice to hang around waiting for inspiration, but you've got to make it happen if it's going to be there. And you lose the gig.
Yeah.
You know, you want to do it or you want someone else to do it. You've got to do it.
Yeah.
So five a week I was, and that went on fares, but it was an invaluable lesson.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I went to Terry Oates there. I was on 25 and luncheon vouchers.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool.
You cracked it.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Gary, what advice would you give to any budding songwriters and producers out there that are listening in now? What would you, I mean, obviously the industry's changed a lot since you started. I mean, it's a different animal now. But what
see, half of our business models collapsed. We used to make half our money from the plays and the sales and the performances. And half from the sales of the records. And of course, when was the last time anyone bought a record? Mm. So that's not been good for us. The download thing, nobody ever made a penny on. Now it's looking like, just because of the amount of people that are streaming, even though we're getting a pittance, it's a big pittance because there's a lot of pittances, you know, so we might be getting to a point. But of course, also it's changed beyond reckoning. Do you know that in last week's chart, the average amount of songwriters on a song was 5.
Amazing.
Well, bearing in mind that no one's buying a record, and you've got to split now 5 ways, and you've got to cut the act in, even though they may not have had anything to do with the actual writing.
Yeah.
And And almost better off if they don't, if they just pretend to be writers. Because when one of the things I think that lyrics, the standard of lyrics is not always so great these days, is that the act is so desperate to be... that no one wants to be a singer. It was good enough for Sinatra not to be a songwriter. It was good enough for Elvis. But they've got to be a singer-songwriter, even if they're not very good. I was mentoring at the Brit School yesterday, and I said to them, I said, you know, if you're a great singer, Aretha was not a songwriter. We don't think any less of her.
No.
She's the greatest voice of the 20th century. We don't think any less of her. We love her. I said, you know, don't expect to be good at this just because you want to be good at it. Don't even expect to be good at it because you're going to the Brit School and having me mentor you. And if your friend writes a better song than you do, record that. Record that song. Did I just shout? Yes, I did. I've been trying because the standard wasn't all that great. And I'm thinking these people are going to have their hearts broken.
But it seems that everybody gets a cut of the writing these days. If you can be a remixer and add a different bass line. And,
oh, it's fantastic.
And you get a co-writer.
I was on the PM show. They asked me how come there were so many writers. I picked up Music Week. This is about 5 years ago. And I found Rita Ora's first hit. There were 11 writers on it.
Now, one song.
They said to me, how is that possible? I said, well, I don't know how it happened on this one, but first of all, I see Berry Gordy's name. So they've sampled something from Motown. Right, so that's one down. Now, a couple of guys have got together and they've put a backing track together. We call that the Beats. And they've done that, and they've got a piece of the song because it's just a chord sequence and a drum pattern. That's what they've done. They bring in a top line writer. Bringing a top line writer, that person is supposed to write the melody and the lyrics.
Yeah.
They write the melody and the lyrics. The melody's actually fine, but the lyrics aren't very good. So you bring in a second top writer. So the first guy's going to get the money. So you've got the two guys that done the beats. You've got Berry Gordy. You've now got the top line writer. Now you've got the second top line writer. They come in. Now you need a bit of a guitar solo. Well, budget's tight, you know, there's not a lot of money. You want a good guitarist, yeah, give him a piece of the song. So in comes the guitarist.
Is that how it works?
I've
always wondered how it works.
Plays a guitar solo.
That all adds up.
Brilliant. But instead of saying, you know, that'd be £100, they say, well, we give you 5%,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
It goes on. Now, we've forgotten the act. I don't know if Rita Ora had anything to do with the writing of this song, but you want to get onto a Rita Ora album, you better put her in on the titles. She may have done and she may not have done. To hear these people talking about, oh, this song I wrote, and then you see and there were seven other people writing. You wonder who did what. I don't want to disrespect her. She sung it perfectly well. I can't remember how it went. But you can see how this mushrooms to a point. Oh, sorry, did I forget the producer? Well, there's three producers, they get a production royalty, but they think they've contributed sufficiently to the structure of it. So that's another three, and suddenly you've got 11 writers. Here's the interesting thing. Rita Ora didn't release a second album for almost 5 years. She's only just put it out last year, the second album. Hasn't done all that well, funnily enough. But her worth was estimated before the second album came out. She was supposed to be worth £10 million. Now, that's not come from record sales. I'm sure plenty of money has come from record sales, but that's from live performances.
Yeah.
That's from being a mentor on The Voice.
Yeah.
That's from advertising this makeup.
Yeah.
That's from being paid to wear this frock at this premiere. That is from all the... That might be from the tour. That might be from the T-shirts at the tour, the souvenir brochure,
merchandise,
the souvenir keyring, the mug. She's worth, before the release of the second, from that one album, worth £10 million. The other 11 writers, they're driving cabs to make a living.
Yeah.
Because you split a song 11 ways... Biggest hit in the world ain't going to give you much if you split it 11 ways, you know. So it's a sad business.
So how, as a budding writer and producer, can you make a career out of it? Or can't you?
Well, it's very difficult to make a career out of it now. Certainly as a writer. Mm. And what people do, because there's very little money actually in the writing, or not as much money as there was. I mean, I remember I was chairman of the Ivors, and I was conscious of the fact that I was giving these £450 much coveted statuettes to people who had very little to do with the writing of the song. Yeah. But if they had a certain percentage of the song... Little Mix, I'm sure they're very talented, I'm sure they're very lovely, but the deal is, on a Little Mix song, they get 20%. They get 5% each of the writing, whether they did it or not. Before you even start, and, you know, that's a trade-off. I'd do it. I'd give it to them. If you and me write a song...
You get a cut on that album, and it's not only, you know, just getting your name out, but it's a prestige and having
and
it on
also,
your CV.
You can't make any money. I sort of want to bring everything down to money, but everyone's got to eat. You cannot... But so I'm going to call it money. You cannot earn a living just out of... just out of writing songs that you like and your mum likes. You have to connect with the public somehow. And also, luck being so important, if you don't have something out there, if you don't get onto that album track, there's no possibility of somebody listening to it and saying, oh, I think I'll do that song, or I think I'll phone that guy up. So the more out there you are, the more chance you've got of being
opening doors.
But what happens now is that the days of just a guy who sits and writes a song, there are a few. There aren't many, and they're the guys who are really making the money, because every time an act comes along, they get put with Egg White, or, you know, Beyonce's got an album, she sits down with some of these professional guys, and she's got some idea, one line, a title, she's suddenly the writer of the whole song.
Gary, can I just ask you, what music are you listening to now? What songwriters are you into? What kind of, what new stuff out there do you appreciate and love at the moment?
It's tricky. I recently turned 70, and I love music. I live for it. But, and I listen, I force myself. Remember, I was 12 years chairman of the Ivors. And therefore, even though that was through between, you know, my late 50s to, up until my late 60s, and I would not normally be listening to what's happening now, we tend to focus in on the music we like and the kind of music we like, and a lot of heritage acts are still going, and I, you know, I'm still more likely to go home and put on an album by the band than I am by anybody that's in the charts right now. But because I was actually chairing Best Song Musically and Lyrically and chairing the Ivors, I had to listen to everything. And so for a guy who in his late 60s, I was right, I had my finger on all. But since I've stopped with that gig, it's been blissful not to have to. I'm sorry. So I'm not listening to as many, more Radio 2 than Radio 1, I've got to say. The song I loved the most in recent times, I think, I made sure it got an Ivor before I left, was I Wasn't Expecting That by Jamie Lawson. Beautiful story. Stunning, about meeting the girl and having the kids and then cancer, all telling, and the beautiful tragic, a beautiful tragic record, beautifully put. But I know, I like all the kinds of music. Remember, I, also my wife is a singer, so she's very big soul and
an amazing
blues
singer.
She's
well,
fantastic, good, very, very black voice. And so we've been married now 18 years and together 25. But I literally fell in love with her voice before I met her. And then I had a song.
Jake came with me to the last Sods do.
You heard Lord
Sing. Beautiful.
So she's, you know, you wouldn't. She can sing any kind of, she's a proper session singer, so, you know, you want a vib, you want to sound you want to sound folky, but she likes to sing. But I am more likely to go back, and I'm steeped in the history, of course, because of my dad. So I'm as likely to spend the evening listening to Louis Armstrong as I am to Muse or whatever that might be more cool and more hip now.
Yeah.
Have you had enough of me yet?
Do you know what? I think we've covered pretty much everything.
As you can tell, this is my favourite subject, and I could talk about me.
It's a wonderful subject.
Hours and hours.
And Gary, thank you so much for joining us, mate. It's been fascinating and lovely to hear your stories and lovely to hear you open your heart to us. And it's beautiful.
And I hope you come back and I'll tell you the truth. Instead of all the lies I told.
We might just do that, mate. So, but thank you.
Thanks, Ricky. Good luck.
Lots of love.
Love ya.
Love you too. Oh, my God. Can you believe that? Gary Osborne. This guy, he personifies the unsung hero. He's been behind so many hits, worked with so many people. He's just worked with everyone and still getting involved in music. You look at the guy and the music just oozes out of his skin. He's just lives and breathes it. And it's beautiful to see someone so passionate. Yeah, I love it. And I love him. And thank you so much, guys, for being involved in this little project of ours. And it's an honour to have you on our show. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to speaking to you all next week, where we will be speaking to some more amazing writers and people behind the scenes. Lots of love to you all. Have a great week. You have been listening to Unsung Heroes with me, Ricky Wilde, Jake Wood and Lee Bennett, produced and created by myself and Jake Wood for Wildwood Productions, with music and editing again by myself, Ricky Wilde, artwork by Scarlett Wild, and hosted by Acast. Just to remind you that there is a link in the notes directing you to a Spotify playlist featuring all the songs we have discussed in this episode. Many thanks for listening. Unsung Heroes.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, Drew Scott here, and I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.